So on to the Q&A. The way we're going to do the Q&A tonight is we have a microphone on the center aisle where Ashley is modeling right there. Thank you, Ashley. So if you have a question, we can form a line up there in the center aisle to ask your question. Then we can get our answers. If you can't make it to the microphone, you can flag Ashley down. She'll be able to bring it to you. But we'll try to keep the questions centered right there, make it a little bit easier on everybody. So it looks like we have a question, so I'll turn it back over to Dr. Lamana, and we'll take it away.
My question is this. Did the geologist who found your bird head record exactly where he found it?
Yes, thankfully he did. So the geologist that works with us, a guy named Eric Roberts, is an extraordinary guy. As a person and as a geologist, and he always recorded everything that he found. So it turns out that boulder, and this was great that it was great that he had the presence of mind to do this, because that boulder came from the same rock layer that yielded the initial specimen of Bagavis, this Cretaceous duck. So there's a chance. I mean, there's not a good chance it belongs to the same individual, but we know it comes from the same fossil horizon. And so that's really important. I mean, obviously, to know the true evolutionary significance of a given fossil, you need to know the age of that fossil. And from there, you need to know where, to get the age, you need to know the rocks it came from. So yes. Thankfully, yes.
Thanks for a great presentation, by the way.
Thanks very much.
My question is sort of testing a line of thinking. There's that saying, scarce as hen's teeth, and the hen's teeth are actually really do happen, right? So you get these vestigial things that come out of the DNA from time to time, but not reliably. I'm wondering, with regard to your theory of aquatic birds being ancestral to all modern birds, if anyone has walked bird genomes sufficiently to see whether there's webbing stashed in DNA across all of them, because if that's true, then it's pretty strong evidence. And if they're pretty sure that it's not, that's pretty strong evidence, unfortunately, in the other direction.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and honestly one that I never thought of. I don't know of any studies that have looked at that, but I think that that's a really good idea.
Send me the royalties.
Okay.
My question is regarding bone density and bone structure. Is that something you can judge in fossils in comparison from historical birds to modern birds? As we know, most modern flighted birds have honeycomb structured bones, mm-hmm. and if that'd be something that you can use to judge evolutionary patterns?
Well, bone density doesn't, and the first part of your question is yes, we can absolutely assess the density of bones in fossils, and also obviously in modern birds as well. The complicating factor is that bone density doesn't seem to track evolution very well, it seems to more track ecology of birds. So diving birds tend to have quite dense bones because they're somewhere, like if you look at penguin bones, for instance, they're very dense as birds go. And that's because we think that, it helps them to get to the, get into the water and stay down. Interestingly, Ganses has fairly dense bones, which suggests that, again, it's probably an aquatic related feature. Of course, the complicating factor is that it's also quite far down the bird evolutionary chain, and so could it be a holdover from its dinosaur ancestors as well? Sort of an interesting sideline to that question is that hollow bones, air-filled bones, which is something that we associate with birds, this actually goes back to the very, very first dinosaurs. Some of the very first dinosaurs also had hollow bones. And so that feature of birds, you break open a chicken bone and you'll see a hollow interior. This is a holdover from their dinosaur ancestors that anybody eating a chicken dinner can experience for themselves. So the short answer is yes, we can figure it out, but the longer answer is it doesn't seem to be a great indicator of evolutionary relationships. Mm-hmm.
I'm a geology major, watch out.
Uh-oh.
So I do know the history of the Liaoning province. I know what makes that area so special to why you have such wonderful preservation of fossils there. And since it was an aquatic environment, could the predominance of aquatic birds there be simply because it is a product of the environment? Is there maybe possibility of some terrestrial birds kind of hiding out in a little corner you haven't found yet? Or do you think maybe your theory of the aquatic origin to all modern birds does hold credence?
That's a question I've gotten many times, and it's an excellent question. The question is basically like, you know, okay, you know, idiot, you're saying that, you know, modern birds originate in aquatic environments. Well, you're looking in an ancient lake, so what do you expect to find? You know, a fantastic question. I think the best counterpoint I can give you to that is that we do find in those feathered dinosaur beds in Liaoning province in China, about 125 million years old, so just a little bit older than the fossils of Ganses, we find lots and lots and lots of fossil birds. And most of what we find are birds with terrestrial adaptations. And so if we're just finding aquatic birds because we're looking in an aquatic environment, you would think that that would also be the case in Liaoning as well. This is an environment type that's thought to be very similar to the environment in the Chiang Mai Basin. A deep lake, probably very slow sedimentation, very fine, quiet waters, you know, things getting out into the middle of the lake. And shockingly enough, we don't find lots and lots of these aquatic type birds. We actually find lots and lots of forest birds, these enantiornithines. So there may, I will absolutely concede that we might be far too early to tell, because as a geology major, you probably know something about the crappy nature of the fossil record, or the generally crappy nature of the fossil record. But I will say that we've got these slightly older rocks in a similar environment that show a predominance of terrestrial birds, and then these slightly younger rocks in a similar environment that show a vast predominance of aquatic-type birds. So there's something interesting there. Whether it's completely preservational, whether it's completely, you know, faunal evolutionary, it's hard to say at this point. But it's I think it's an interesting counterpoint to the argument that you made. But excellent question.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. One is, what was the paleo environment like of Ganses? I mean, Antarctica, where was that latitude-wise 50 million years ago?
Sure. So first of all, the paleo environment of Ganses is thought to have been a really big lake. We don't know much about it other than that. We do find lots of fossil plants, lots of terrestrial insects, lots of turtles, lots of other kinds of creatures. It seems to have been a very large lake. We don't really know the dimensions of it. But the climate was probably, by the standards of the age of dinosaurs, not overly warm. Probably temperate. So it's in the interior of the vast Asian continent, just like it is today. That part of Asia, unlike many areas during the age of dinosaurs, that part of Asia was not thought to have been flooded by big seaways. So this basin, the Chiang Mai Basin, would have been very, very far inland. So think of a deep inland lake. Judging from the plants we find around it, probably a temperate environment. We find a lot of conifer tree leaves and things like this. Insects that would look very familiar to modern eyes. Lots and lots of kinds of insects as well. Second question was about the latitude of Antarctica during the age of dinosaurs. It actually was, we think, about the same place it is now. Believe it or not, most people, when I show, you know, pictures of Antarctic fossil leaves, they think, oh, well, it must have, you know, the people that know something about the history of the Earth know that the continents have moved around. Well, since the age of dinosaurs, Antarctica, we think, has mostly sat in the same place, and so the climatic differences, the very extreme climatic differences between the Antarctica of then and the Antarctica of now are not due mostly to changes in geographic position. In other words, it was also, just like today, at the South Pole. And interestingly, that's interesting because it gives us the Antarctica at the end of the Age of Dinosaurs was probably an environment that has no exact modern counterpart. It was an environment that would have experienced, 6 months of darkness, just like the poles do today, but not the extreme cold temperatures that the North Pole and the South Pole do today. So, so it poses all kinds of questions from that standpoint.
Because they showed in the textbooks that, they were finding coal down there, and so that was a tropical environment. So,
yep, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and actually, many of the coal deposits are quite a bit older, and that was when Antarctica was in a different position. Okay. But at the end of the Age of Dinosaurs, more or less in the same place as it is now.
Okay. And lastly, might paleontologists ever have room for high school science teachers on any of their expeditions?
The short answer is yes, but Antarctica is very difficult. But many of the other expeditions, yes. I'm going to take his question first, just because he's... Enantiornithines.
Died out with the dinosaurs and the ones that went on to become the modern birds.
Yeah.
My question is, would you speculate at all whether or what could have been the selective advantages that the group that survived had after the asteroid hit and the climate change and the food disappeared? And why and what could that group have had to promote its
So, first of all, I'm going to tell you guys, this is a great bunch of your questions have been fantastic so far, and that's another fantastic one. So the question is, for anybody that couldn't hear in the back, the question is, you know, I mentioned these opposite birds, these enantiornithine birds, this dominant radiation of birds during the age of dinosaurs that went completely extinct at the end of the age of dinosaurs, and you know, the modern bird group, which... seemingly, and I don't think I talked about this, but seemingly was quite a bit less common, was the one that survived. Why, you know, why is that? Well, I don't have an easy answer for that. I don't think anybody does. But one interesting thing is that, and you hinted at this in asking the question, the killing mechanism at the end of the age of dinosaurs is regarded by most paleontologists, most scientists, as you know, as probably a gigantic asteroid impact, maybe coupled with things like increased volcanic activity, you know, climate change of some form or another. Now the asteroid hypothesis is probably the most predominant. Now, obviously, anything standing within the blast radius is going to be annihilated completely. But it's not that we think that actually does in most of the animals. We think that probably this asteroid hit and it blasted up a bunch of dust and gas into the sky, you know, blocked out sunlight, which leads to, you know, plants can't photosynthesize, which leads to ecosystems starting to collapse. Now, interestingly, I just told you that, according to our work at least, we think that modern birds may have originated in aquatic environments, and we think that the oldest known members of the modern bird group come from Antarctica. So there's two different interesting things there. There have been studies that have been shown. The extinction at the end of the age of dinosaurs is very mysterious. It's strange as to what survived and what didn't. But one of the things that has been shown is that animals that seem to have lived in and near water seem to have done better at the end of the age of dinosaurs than animals that didn't. And so it's possible that if, and this is a big if the modern bird group was adapted to aquatic environments, that may have predisposed them to survive in, you know, this big cataclysm that happened at the end of the age of dinosaurs. The other thing is, I mentioned that the asteroid impact or volcanic activity or whatever, you know, most different extinction scenarios have the component that a lot of gas and dust gets blasted into the atmosphere and blocks out sunlight. So if you've got animals that are living in Antarctica, where they experience 6 months of darkness every year anyway, wouldn't that be another possible thing that might have pre-adapted them to survive? So probably, like most, you know, like most animals that survive mass extinctions, in some sense it was dumb luck. You know, if it, and again, I'm going out onto a huge speculative limb here, but if this is the case, you know, then maybe, just maybe, animals that were adapted to aquatic environments and animals that were adapted to deal with long periods of darkness may have been favored. And that just so happens to be what we think the modern bird group was doing at the end of the age of dinosaurs. Thanks. I need to, like, show that.
My question was about, like, is there agreement or how covered in feathers do you think dinosaurs were? Like, because I feel like I've seen different depictions of it where sometimes they only have a little and sometimes they're just like birds. So.
Yeah. So first of all, the reason, and he's absolutely right, you see widely varying depictions of dinosaurs, you know. Sometimes you see a T-Rex covered in fuzz, sometimes the T-Rex is scaly, sometimes it's half fuzzy and half scaly. And this is because for a lot of dinosaurs, we don't actually have very much evidence as to what their skin covering was like. So there's a lot of, you know, sort of poetic license that goes into, you know, to reconstructing these animals. It seems to have, this is not much of an answer, but it seems to have varied quite a lot. So with dinosaurs that are quite closely related to birds, we have fossil specimens of them that are preserved with feathers pretty much all over their bodies. So we know that, you know, creatures like Velociraptor, one of the most close, Velociraptor is just about as close as you can be to a bird without being a bird yourself. We know that this animal or close relatives of it were totally covered in feathers. Things like the chicken from hell, this Oviraptorus or Anzu that we named 6 weeks ago, that thing was almost certainly fully covered in feathers. Things where it gets trickier are things like T-Rex, where you're on the line to modern birds, but there's still a long ways to go. And so for many of these animals, we don't have skin impressions for most parts of the body. So we literally can't tell whether, you know, whether it was all scaly, all feathery, or some of both. I guess if I had to, you know, if I was in Vegas and I had to make a bet on this, I would say T-Rex probably had filaments on some parts of its body. The little tiny patch of skin, there's out of the 50 specimens of T-Rex that are known right now, one of them, only one of them, has a little tiny patch of skin about this big, which is, you know, on a 40-foot-long animal, not very much of the body. That part is scaly, so we know that at least part of T-Rex was scaly. So any reconstructions you see of T-Rex completely covered in fuzz are wrong. All right, a definitive answer for once. Oh, great. apart from that, we don't know for sure, and there's a vast number of dinosaurs for which we have no evidence as to what the body covering was like.
Is there DNA available for
No, DNA is never, yes, it's not been preserved with any dinosaur.
Well, I was going to ask that question about DNA, but obviously that you haven't gotten DNA from any of these samples in Antarctica. But you said that the feathered dinosaurs in eastern China were because that was the perfect environment. The other possibility is that they couldn't fly very far, and therefore they were not able to, you know, to move to other places, and that's the only place you could find. So could you tell from the feathers they could fly long distance or not?
Okay, so there's a couple different things in there. First of all, could birds from the age of dinosaurs fly long distances? Well, like, you know, as is the case for modern birds, different birds from the age of dinosaurs probably had very different flight capabilities. Most people think that Archaeopteryx, some of these, you know, these very, very archaic birds, these things probably couldn't fly very much at all. I mean, they might have been... There are some people that tell you that Archaeopteryx couldn't fly. I mean, it would just glide from tree to tree. There are other people that would tell you that, yeah, it could fly a little bit. You know, nobody claims that it could, you know, migrate long distances or anything like this. So it's pretty clear that some of the most primitive birds couldn't really do much flying. When you get up to the level of things like Gansus has, one of our specimens of Gansus, this is the most peculiar thing. The thing's been crushed flat to the point where the animal's lying on its back and the vertebrae from the back have actually been crushed through the breastbone. So you can see so imagine I'm a bird lying on my back and I've been splattered almost two-dimensionally, so my backbones are actually coming up through my chest. In that specimen, even though that's happened, the keel of the breastbone, when you're carving a turkey at Thanksgiving, you know, and you see that big, you know, the big rod of bone that sticks up towards you where the white meat is all distributed on either side of that, that is totally intact in the specimen of Gansus. So it's really, really bizarre. And it shows us that Gansus had a very large keel, a very large prong of bone on its breastbone that suggests the attachment of very powerful flight muscles. So at least at the level of Gansus, things were able to fly and probably fly quite well. So the answer to that is a wide variety of things. And probably things like Bagavis, by the time you get to the end of the age of dinosaurs, these are animals that are probably flying as well as modern birds. As to why we only find soft tissues, things like feathers, skin, fur in the cases of mammals, in these very special environments, we don't think it has to do with the dispersal abilities of the animals in those environments. In other words, we don't think it has to do with things getting to them. We think it has to do with what happens to those things after their carcasses arrive there. So most of these places that produce feathers, that produce skin, they have a couple of things in common. They tend to be really quiet water environments, So things like Archaeopteryx, which is preserved with feathers, is thought to have died in an ancient lagoon where, in which the bottom waters were very quiet, like nothing around to, you know, the currents are very, very low, nothing's around to disturb them. These feathered dinosaurs from northeastern China are thought to have, you know, floated out to the middle of a lake and sank to the bottom. Same thing with Ganses from the Changma Basin and many other instances of exceptional preservation. And what we think happens is these sink to the bottom of a lake or a lagoon or some other place where it's really, really quiet at the bottom. And these places are deep enough such that the bottom waters, the water at the bottom of the lake is what we call anoxic. In other words, it lacks oxygen. And that precludes, if you're in an anoxic environment, that means that most big scavengers aren't going to be able to get there. In fact, the only things that can scavenge your carcass are what we call anaerobic bacteria. In other words, bacteria that don't need oxygen to survive. And so we think it's a combination of quiet water, very fine-grained sediment, anoxic conditions, and all of these things, if you get the very, very perfect circumstance, can combine to preserve things that we don't often see in the fossil record, such as feathers, such as skin, such as fur. So, long answer. Hopefully I got it. We have never looked for mitochondrial DNA. It's thought that DNA degrades very, very rapidly. So when we're talking about animals that are tens, if not hundreds of millions of years old, at least with current techniques, there's no way to recover them. No way to recover DNA. No one has ever, despite what you know, obviously what you saw in Jurassic Park and what you might read in the media, nobody has ever recovered DNA from a dinosaur. That being said, people have recovered proteins and other microscopic biological structures, such as things like that seem to be red blood cells, things that seem to be blood vessels. So there's a very special T-Rex from which proteins, blood cells, and blood vessels have been discovered from an animal that's 67 million years old. So right now, it's not possible to recover DNA from a dinosaur, but, you know, I would be stupid to say that, you know, that it'll never be possible because we can't predict that. So,
excuse me. Has there been any information about these pre-birds migrating?
The question is, were archaic birds, in other words, birds from the age of dinosaurs, able to migrate? And the answer is we don't know for sure. Most of these things are found from one single site. And so, you know, one very powerful evidence of migration, if you could find it, would be to say, you know, okay, let's say we have Ganses at this site in northwestern China. And hypothetically, let's say we find Ganses also in Australia, for instance, an area that we know was separated by thousands of miles and vast expanses of ocean at that time. That would be pretty good evidence that Ganses was migratory. Unfortunately, we haven't found that for Ganses or any other bird from the age of dinosaurs. Now, I laughed when you asked that question just because it's something I thought about myself quite a lot. I took this slide out of my talk. But since our 2006 paper, since that initial paper on Ganses, we found lots more specimens of that bird. And some of those specimens have what we call gastroliths, stomach stones, rocks that the birds were ingesting on purpose for some reason, probably to grind up their food, maybe to weigh themselves down if they were diving into water, things like that. The reason I bring this up is that I have a colleague, a fellow scientist, who studies the origins of rocks. In other words, he can look at a rock and tell you at least approximately where the source of that rock. In other words, like if a sedimentary rock is think of like a gravel at the bottom of a stream. He can tell where certain pebbles in that gravel would have come from. And so I asked him one day, almost as a joke, I said, you know, we've got all these specimens of Ganses that have rocks in their guts. Could you tell me where they're picking them up from? And he said, yeah, probably. And so if we can establish that these things are picking these things up from areas very far away from northwestern China, we might have pretty decent evidence that these things were migrating or at least traveling long distances. The short answer is we don't know at the moment, but we might be able to find out. Ben.
About the KT thing and how the aquatic birds in the southern hemisphere seem to have survived.
So the observation, well, the first of all I can say is strong with the force are you. The second thing I'll say is that he just said that the records from paleobotany show that there's what we call a fern spike, a spike in fern spores at the end of the age of dinosaurs, or just after the end of the age of dinosaurs, that's attributed to the proliferation of ferns after many other kinds of plant life were wiped out after this big, you know, big cataclysm of whatever kind it was, you know, asteroid impact, increased volcanic activity, or whatever. And so Ben's observation was that in the southern hemisphere, this fern spike seems to be less, you know, less predominant. That's a very interesting observation. It may be more than coincidence that the modern birds that we find are living in the far southern hemisphere. And so it's possible that, you know, maybe if we can, you know, jump out onto our speculative limb a little bit further here, we can say that, you know, maybe aquatic adaptations coupled with 6 months of darkness, coupled with even the possibility that the extinction may not have been as severe in the southern hemisphere, may have been another factor that favored the survival of modern birds at the end of the age of dinosaurs. So, excellent point.
The chicken from hell didn't look like it could fly. Why would it have had feathers?
Okay, so yes, and you're absolutely right. The chicken from hell could not fly. This is a dinosaur called Anzu wilii that some friends and I named a few weeks ago. This thing was undoubtedly flightless. It was about 500 pounds, and the you know, so you need to get an animal that size in the air, you need a wingspan, a very substantial wingspan. You're talking like probably like a 737 or something. Now, the largest flying animal of all time is a pterosaur, a flying reptile. You know, they're often called pterodactyls. An animal like a creature called Quetzalcoatlus. And that thing, even though it has a wingspan of 35 feet, is probably only, you know, say a couple hundred pounds. So this, you know, to get an animal off the ground that of that size is a tremendous feat and something that, you know. So why did Anzu have feathers if it couldn't fly? Well, there's a lot of different possibilities, but maybe I would say the most likely is feathers make really great insulation. Think of a down sleeping bag if you've been camping in cold temperatures, something like this. Down blanket in the winter, whatever. It's thought, obviously modern birds are warm-blooded. In fact, they're extremely warm-blooded, more warm-blooded than we are. And it's thought that at least some non-avian dinosaurs, in other words, animals on the line to birds, probably regulated their temperature to some degree. Whether we can say that, we can't say that for certain, but it's quite likely that at least some of them did. And so that, if that's the case, if you'll entertain that for a second, that gives you a likely explanation for the evolution of feathers in flightless animals, or at least in flightless non-avian dinosaurs. In other words, if you're a dinosaur that's generating your own body heat, it makes sense to insulate yourself in some way, and feathers may have been that way. One interesting thing about that is when we first see feather-like structures appear in the fossil record, they're clearly not for flight. They're not adapted for flight. Even if you had, you know, the wingspan of a 727, you wouldn't be able to get off the ground with these things because they're just little filaments. They're like our hairs. And so, you know, what is fur good for in mammals? It's great for insulation. So insulation is, I would say, is probably the most likely explanation as to why things like the chicken from hell were covered in feathers. One other possibility is that they use them for display, something like a peacock uses its ridiculous tail to show off to, you know, the members of the opposite gender, things like this.
Did you ever have a supposition as to why you got so many in one area? What killed them? Why are they there? Such a large volume.
I always like answering questions because it's like, I know if I did a good job in the talk, if people are asking good questions, it means people are paying attention. That's another great one. So I mentioned that in northwestern China, in the Changhua Basin, we've got, you know, you can dig and dig and dig and you don't find much of anything, at least in terms of birds, for many, 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 many feet of rock. I mean, you can move a lot of rock. You can turn a lot of pages back and not find much of anything. But when you get to this one particular layer about 3 feet thick, you find lots and lots and lots of bones of Ganses and other kinds of birds. What killed them all? Another fantastic question. We don't have a good answer for that. And it's I can tell you that it's not one of these like sort of dinosaur Pompeii's that you read about. People do find layers of dinosaur fossils, of fossil birds, of different kinds of creatures. There's a famous place in Nebraska where lots and lots of fossil rhinos were killed all at once, thought to be by a volcanic eruption. And we do find this with dinosaurs sometimes. In the Changma Basin, this is not what's happening. There are no geological indications of any kind of catastrophic assemblage like that. One thing that's occurred to us is maybe we're just getting into the environment that these things lived in when we get into this layer. Because you imagine over time, the shore of a lake is going to migrate back and forth as the lake gets deeper and the lake gets shallower, you know, over geologic time, over many, many tens of decades, things like this. And so if we're digging in the same spot, we're sampling, you know, the same point in time, the same geographic point at many different times. And so you can imagine that at some times, we're going to be out in the middle of the lake, and other times we're going to be at the near the shore, and you know, and you know, and everywhere in between. And so when we've encountered these layers of bird fossils, or layers that are rich in bird fossils, we've suspected that we're probably just in the layer of time that happened to be where these birds were living. In other words, let's imagine that they like to live near the beach. Well, you know, maybe down here at this level of the rock, you know, if we're standing in this spot and we're sampling this layer of rock, maybe we're sampling the bottom of the lake and where they're not living very frequently. But as we go up in the rock section, we're changing in time. And as, you know, if you could go back in time and watch the lake, you know, kind of expand and contract, you would see it changing the shoreline as well. So by standing in the same spot, but digging in subsequent layers of rock, in other words, moving forward in time, we're sampling different areas of the environment. And so we think that maybe that's just the case, is that when we hit this Ganses layer, we're finally hitting the sweet spot where these things lived most frequently. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but you also said birds are hot-blooded?
Yes.
And reptiles are cold-blooded?
Yes.
How
they come together? Oh, another good question. Well, all I can tell you is that organisms change over evolutionary time. And so, you know, even though ultimately birds came from a cold-blooded ancestor, if you look far back enough in time, at some point warm-bloodedness evolved, just the same way feathers evolved, and just the same way hollow bones evolved, and all these other things that are characteristic of birds. So at some point they had to evolve a warm-blooded physiology too. And we actually don't know exactly where that was in evolutionary time. And you can imagine, you can probably figure out why this is. Things like warm blood don't fossilize directly. You know, we can find feathers on a dinosaur, and we can, you know, look at the isotopic composition of dinosaur bones and all these other indirect indicators of what the body temperature might have been like, but we can't, without a time machine, we can't go back and measure a dinosaur's temperature directly. So we can't tell for sure whether, you know, warm-bloodedness evolved, say, at the level of T-Rex or, say, at the level of Ganses. All we know is that at some point between crocodiles on one side and birds on the other, warm-bloodedness must have evolved. That's actually feeds into a larger point and something that might not be apparent to everybody here. When we're trying to reconstruct many aspects of dinosaur biology, many of these things that don't fossilize, such as color, warm-bloodedness, what kinds of sounds they made, whether they took care of their young, almost all of these things, we do this by, in many cases, we do this by looking at crocodiles on one side and birds on the other. And this is because we believe that non-avian dinosaurs, in other words, every single thing that you've ever considered a dinosaur, T-Rex, Brontosaurus, Velociraptor, whatever, we think that they're sandwiched on the evolutionary tree between crocs on one side and birds on the other. And so the thinking goes that if you can find something that a croc does and that, say, an ostrich does, there's a good chance that dinosaurs did it too, because it's likely to be evolutionarily conserved. In other words, it's what we call, it's called Occam's razor. The simplest answer is the best one. So, little tangent, but hopefully a useful one. Question, Ben. Ben, you should be up here doing this. So the question was, could warm-bloodedness have evolved even before dinosaurs when there were widespread ice ages late in the what's called the Paleozoic era, the era before the age of dinosaurs, the Mesozoic era? And that's quite possible, for sure. We know that during that time, the dominant or one of the dominant kinds of creatures were what we call therapsids. These are animals that are related to mammals that probably, in many cases, had some kind of warm-blooded physiology that might have been selected for because of, you know, global cooling, in particular at the end of the what's called the Carboniferous period. So yes, it's possible. It might have. That would be, for me, about a 50-50. But it's something that, you know, you got a lot of time, you know. This is something you can figure out. Anybody else?
Any other questions? All right, well, thank you, Dr. Lamana. And thank everybody for coming out tonight. Hopefully we'll see you next month on June 2nd. Safe travels.